extremely interesting approach, and I'm going to give a slightly different one, but then we'll try to see if we can confront the two views together, because there are points of agreement. Louder? Maybe if I aim the mic this way, you can hear what I'm saying. Is that better?
Yes.
So I hope there are points of agreement and points of disagreement, and I hope we can bring these out. And Craig Calhoun will help us to bring these out afterwards. So let me try to set out why I think we need another concept of secularism from the one we've been operating with. So I'll try to lay out two ideas of what secularist regimes are, secularist arrangements. If we're speaking French, laïcité or laïque. What two concepts of what these arrangements are all about, and plead very strongly for number two as against number one, which has tended to be the dominant one up to now. Now, I have to say at the beginning that we're all very partial in the sense of our experience is very restricted because we're living in one society and not another, and the problems appear to us the way they become salient in the societies we're really familiar with. So I admit right away that this is an analysis which is very influenced by life in my own country, Canada, but in particular Quebec, where we had a big discussion about this a couple of years ago with a public commission and so on. So that's said as a kind of demural or self-limiting remark at the beginning, but I'm going to jump in with what I hope is a very general theory, which will rapidly perhaps reveal its limitations. Okay, so the two notions of what the secular are about are, one, what we need a secular regime for is to contain or control or set the space of religion in our modern secular societies. Secularism is concerned with, if you like, controlling or containing religion. The second view, which is the one I want to plead for, is a view that starts in a quite different direction and way. It starts off defining what the goals are of a secularist regime. What do we want to promote? What do we want to maximize? And there are various ways of setting these goals. I'm going to offer a tripartite, three principles as a good definition of them. The first goal is we want a regime in which there is the maximum freedom of conscience. I mean, freedom of people to follow what they conscientiously think they ought to follow in terms of ways of life, whether their conscience be informed by a religious outlook or by a non-religious philosophy or whatever. Freedom of conscience is the first goal. The second goal is equality here between people with different ways of informing their conscience, equality between people with different outlooks, be they religious or non-religious or anti-religious or whatever, right? So in a certain sense, a freedom component, an equality component. And I would like to add a third component whose relevance will be clearer a bit later on, that in the process of determining what these first two goals mean, and they always require a lot of interpretation, we have a maximally open discussion in which the people who speak for and think in terms of all these different points of view can have serious input into that debate, right? So, in a certain sense, you can say that this second definition, religion is not the central thing. It's not about religion anymore, which is what people think of when they think of secularism in the first definition. It's not about religion, first of all, because even one of the most important elements for religious people in any constitution, namely the assurance of freedom to practice their religion, what you in the United States call free exercise, according to the hallowed words of the First Amendment, even that is something which follows from a more general principle, the principle of freedom of exercise, of conscience, which of course for religious people means religiously informed conscience, but for other people can mean something else. And then you can see that this whole way of looking at it centers centers the problem in a quite different way. Now, I want to give two very important reasons why I think this is a very much superior way. Well, I'll throw in a third one, but to start off with two reasons why I think it's really helpful. The first is that if you start off with these three principles, you can see right away that they can run into certain conflicts with each other, right? That try to maximize freedom of exercise can run into problems about maximizing equality or maximizing the neutrality of the public institutions, which is an important component of any equality between different views, because it obviously belongs to them, belongs to this equality that no particular religious or metaphysical or spiritual family control the state or have a privileged position in the state, right? So you can get situations in which these two goals seem to come run against each other, and I'm going to come to an example which I think will illustrate that in a minute. Once you see that there can be conflict, you see also that there can be dilemmas, really tough dilemmas, that where they have to be resolved by a great deal of thought and a great deal of attention to the particular situation in which you are, so that we not only have in this field dilemmas, we have dilemmas that don't have obvious universal solutions. I mean, the way of resolving them would depend very much on local circumstances and would be different in Germany and in Quebec and in the United States and in France and elsewhere. The important point I'm bringing out here is that the dilemmatic nature, the fact that we're dealing with dilemmas, comes right out, hits you in the face, if you have this way of looking at secularism. Now, if you have the other way, the point is, in some sense, giving religion its place, you have a temptation, and we've seen this historically, for people to think that there's a single principle. The principle which best expresses the place of religion. This could be called separation of church and state, or wall of separation, or in the case of societies that operate on the Francophone set of concepts that we see in Quebec and in France, laïcité, les espaces publics de la République, and so on. La neutralité de l'espace public, all these slogans, which give one the impression, and this is something I'm not just inventing, but it's something that I've experienced in actual debates with people thinking in these concepts, gives the impression that there is a single answer to every issue, namely the one which will maximize the single principle, right? Be it laïcité or the wall of separation and so on. So my first claim is that thinking in these terms, in terms of the religion controlling view, tends to obfuscate, occult, hide from you the fact that you're dealing with dilemmas all the time, and that the resolution of these is not obvious and certainly not deducible from a universal principle, because as I said earlier, these dilemmas have to be resolved within the actual context that they arise in. So, I mean, let's give an example. I think it'll help. An example that is terribly important in the French debate recently and was terribly important in the Quebec debate, so that I'm bringing it up. And it's not terribly relevant to you, I'm sorry, but that reflects, if you like, the parochial nature of my thinking. But I think we're all a little bit parochial in this. It's the issue for Muslim schoolgirls of whether they should be allowed to wear the hijab, the foulard, the scarf in public schools. As you know, that was a big debate in France that was, in a certain sense, the important content of the debates of the Stasi Commission in France. And then there was a law that emanated from the report of that commission, which forbade the wearing of the hijab by Muslim girls in the public schools in France. Now, similar issue arose in one of the Länder in Germany, Baden-Württemberg is at Hesse and so on, in which another decision was taken, very interestingly different, that there would not be a limitation on the schoolgirls wearing the hijab, but if a Muslim female teacher wanted to wear it in the school, that was not possible. Right? And in other jurisdictions like the UK and Quebec and so on, there is no interdiction on either level. What's going on here? What's going on is that people are sensitive to two things. They're sensitive to the freedom of practice, the freedom of exercise, which would incline you to say, let them wear the hijab if they think in conscience that's what they ought to do. But then people are also saying, but look, the schools in question are public schools, the schools in question are, if you like, state schools, the schools in question are emanations of the state. The emanations of the state, which is the instrument for everybody from all kinds of points of view, has to be in some sense neutral between these points of view. And so we can't let this go too far. And what you see here, the variety of answers to this question, and I'm not saying I agree with any particular one of them, even in their context, but the answers to this question reflect the dilemmatic underlying problem here, and people making different assessments of what the two demands are and how best to fit them together. Or let me put it this way, that's what these answers, in my view, should reflect. That is, they should reflect this kind of careful discussion. We have this goal here, we have that goal there, how are we going to bring them together? But very often, if you look closely, for instance, at the discussion in France in 2003, the time of the Stasi Commission, the public discussion, and I regret to say, if you look closely at the actual discussion on the Stasi Commission, very often you have the other kind of logic. The logic, we have a basic principle, la laïcité in our constitution, in our republic, it comes to us from the founders, and what does this demand? It demands, and so on. And the speaker, as it were, deduces the answer that they're supporting from this single principle. Well, that is the first very important reason why I favor this other view. Let's say the diversity view is against the religion-controlling view, that it brings out into the open what the debate is really about and allows us to address it without the false belief that there's some single, simple solution. We just have to look, stare at the principle long enough, and it'll give us the answer. The second important reason why I favor this view over the other one, the diversity view, let's say, over the religion-controlling view, is that the goal, as far as the second view is concerned, is very clearly, yes, a neutral state, but not just neutral between religious views, but neutral between religious views, non-religious views, anti-religious views, and so on. It's very easy, if you're thinking in terms of the religion-controlling conception, to slide into a view that it's religion which makes the problem and religion which has to be contained in order to minimize the problem, and to fail to pick up on cases in which legislation is in violation of the real neutrality principle in the sense that it, but by treating religion as a special case, it very often is putting restrictions on it that it does not put on other views. And the consequences of this, when they're at their worst, are that cases like the Turkish Kemalist secularist case are very often discussed as though they were genuine secularist regimes, which, from the standpoint of a religion-controlling view, they might be because they are exercises in the control of religion. From the standpoint of the view I'm offering, diversity view, they're scandalously at variance with this because we have not a real separation, if you like, of church and state or ummah and state, but you have the Sunni imams trained by a state ministry and told what to say in their sermons. They have no recognition of more, if you like, heretical Muslim modes of belief, like the Alevi, who can't open officially mosques. I mean, we could go on and go on and go on in the long list of these. This is not, from the standpoint of the diversity concept, this is just, you know, kilometers away from a real secularist regime. And the point, again, about the superiority of the second view, I think, is that once again, that fact jumps out at you if you're looking at it from this point of view, Whereas it doesn't necessarily jump out at you if you're looking at it from the other point of view. So in a sense, what I want to say is that the secularism isn't about, especially about religion. That sounds very strange. And that any attempt to define it, which makes religion into a kind of special problem or special case, is already going off in the wrong direction. Now, there's a history behind this. I mean, both the word secularist and the word laïque, or laïcité in French, they both issue from a history in which there was a big battle with a church or some churches or some religious institutions. I mean, interestingly enough, my second model, the diversity model, was, in a certain sense, the original model in this country. It was the original model of the, you could say, of the American founders, that it was, there was an attempt within a relatively narrow population base, I mean, narrow range of religious views in a population base, basically forms of Protestant Christianity, just taken, given that as the context, it was an attempt to establish a really neutral state, unconnected from any of these. The thing is that, of course, that population base didn't remain. The Catholics started to come here, and the people from all kinds of religious and non-religious views began to come here. And you had in the 19th century in this country a certain reaction on the part of the original, many people in the original Protestant majority who thought, well, we have separation of church and state, but we don't have we can't consider that the United States is religiously neutral. It's a Christian country. And there actually was an attempt by some people to put an amendment in the Constitution that the United States is a Christian country. And that failed. But there was a fight over that. And in this fight, a lot of people, I mean, a lot of Catholics, Jews, and non-Protestants joined forces with a lot of people who were, we would say today, secularists and used the word themselves to fight back against this. So you get the evolution of the United States case, which we're all familiar with, in which the broadening of the walls of what you might consider the category of what you might consider religious positions. And it's interesting that the word secularist begins to be used in the United States in those debates, whereas it hadn't figured, of course, in the founding period. Similarly, the word laïque comes to us from a France where there was a knockdown, drag-out struggle with a potentially hegemonic church over against the forces of the Republican Constitution, of a church that was aligned with a monarchy. I mean, it was a very complicated battle. So it's quite understandable that history has made it the case that in the two, perhaps not justifiably, but nevertheless, the two most famous cases in the West where secularist or laic regimes have grown up, namely this country and France, the term secularist has acquired this twist, as it were, of being mainly focused on religion, from the battle against the attempted amendment that the U.S. was a Christian country in the 19th century, and not anything like as serious a battle as the French battle, but with analogies to the French battle of Republicans against monarcho-Catholics. However, in both these cases, you see that, and this is my third reason, the whole population base of these societies has very much changed, in some cases very radically changed. Why? Because of the immense pluralization. I mean, this is more dramatic in Europe, in a country like France, where the entire ideology, which was focused on fighting back against this single, giant, dangerous religious group, is now in a world in which certainly the second largest religion in France is Islam, in which there are lots of people who practice religions that had no locus standi in those societies in the past. In other words, we're living in societies where the really deep issue for democracy is diversity and how to live with it. And so this is the third reason why I think we have to read to shift our whole definition. Well, now how does this alternative model work? And here I want to connect up with some of the things that Jorgen was saying kind of from a different standpoint. What is the sacred, if you like, or what is the inherited view, the view of the political that develops in these societies, which or would develop in these societies to the extent that their secularist regime follows the model, diversity model I'm describing. Let me try to introduce a couple of concepts, just terms of art, in order to make this clear. The secularist regime I'm describing with the three principles, this is part of, in a certain sense, a public political ethic, along with such crucial elements as a recognition of human rights on one hand, a recognition of the importance of equality and non-discrimination, and let's add a third element here, or a fourth element if you like, the importance of democracy. Now, this is the kind of the core public ethic which we see in virtually all Western democracies today, and very often it's formalized in a constitution, a charter of rights, and so on. These four elements, a secular regime, a regime of human rights, a regime of equality, a regime of democracy. Let me call this core notion a civil doctrine. You might smell a little bit Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the background, right? La religion civile, a civil religion, yes. And I mean to ring those bells, but I mean to ring those bells by remarking the difference. This is not, precisely not, a civil religion. It's a civil doctrine. Okay, how does it relate to a possible civil religion, like the one Rousseau proposed, which would, on the basis of some religious view, enshrine this core, say, yes, for these reasons, in terms of our religious outlook, we want to support this core of four elements. Well, the point is, and here I'm borrowing the basic concept from Rawls, that there couldn't be such a religious background which was part of the common belief and common core of allegiance of that society. Why? Well, because its members have tremendous differences in their outlook. So if you could have a society, if we do, I hope, have societies in which this common core is accepted by the vast majority, in any case, as really ethically binding, it would have to be a society in which the religious or philosophical or other deeper reasons why you and you and you and she and he and so on accept this will be different, will not be shared. In a certain sense, the core is central, is shared, is considered absolutely defining of the society, but the deeper reasons why people, if you like, buy into this are not. That is the basic idea behind the Rawlsian notion of overlapping consensus, which Jorgen also mentioned. And this is the kind of way in which a society operating on the second definition of secularism would have to function. A civil doctrine, but not a civil religion. And not a civil anti-religion either. I mean, in a certain sense, the original French Jacobins had a whole philosophy about what human life was about and so on, which was a non-religious philosophy, and they wanted to anchor their own sense of what their state was about in this philosophy. See, now we can try to link up perhaps with the issue that certainly Jorgen touched on of what are the continuities and discontinuities between ourselves living in this kind of liberal society and the earlier views about the political as some kind of marriage between the cosmically divine or the cosmically higher and political authority. Well, I think the big break comes in the 17th century, in a certain sense, where, take a thinker like Locke as an example. What is divine here the divine here is the natural law. The natural law which tells us what the principles of legitimate authority are and what limits it has to respect. So divinity, or if you like, what emanates from the divine and so on, has shifted from something coterminous with the authority itself, which is what you would have with the idea of a monarchy blessed by God and so on, to the law itself. And in the counter move to that that you get in the Jacobin wing of Jacobin tradition of the French Revolution, and I want to carry that on to the Republican struggles in the 1890s and 1900, and you get a figure like Durkheim, who in a certain sense reflects this. Durkheim puts forward the theory that property runs society, always is held together in a certain sense by some understanding of the sacred. Right? Only, he said, something big has happened which my monarchist Catholic opponents do not yet understand, that the locus of the sacred has moved from the authority to the rights of the human individual. Right? It is les droits de l'homme that are le sacré, the rights of the human beings, which are the sacred in this society. Right? Okay, what Durkheim was offering his friends in the Republican wing of the Third Republic was what I want to call a lay civil religion, or a civil anti-religion. In other words, it would marry together these core political principles with a profound and satisfying foundation, which would both together be part of what bind us together in the state. Now, I want to claim that that is something that is not possible. That's ruled out by the particular definition of secularism that I'm trying to describe here. There has to be a core that we sign on to, human rights, equality, democracy, and the secular regime itself, which really flows from that. But we have very different reasons. If you like, the sacred, having migrated from the authority to the law, has now migrated again. It's no longer part of the commonly understood, accepted law. It is part of what each one of us or different groups of us conceive as, for our part, what motivates us to embrace that. And so here we have, I think, one of the reasons why this particular view that I'm putting forward, in a certain sense, is more difficult than anything else that's been tried in human history. It's more difficult, I'm going to give three reasons for this and then quickly close on that. It's more difficult because it's certainly something we've been used to for many centuries in Europe but elsewhere, that the principles on which political authority is exercised must be backed by the most profound, sacred, or generally deeply accepted principles that we all accept. That's the thing that made it seem self-evident to certain few centuries ago in Europe that a property-run monarchy had to be a confessional monarchy. It's what made it obvious in the solution to the religious wars in Germany that you have to declare that cuius regio es religio, that the religion of the prince should be the religion of the people. So how could, how can you possibly have unity without that? This is a self-evident idea. I think that Durkheim and the Third Republic, Republicans, many of them, and not all of them, Jaurès was an exception, there was very, very honorable and important exceptions here, were in a sense operating with the same principle, only they would turn it around and have a purely laïque, as it were, civil religion. And I think that we're moving into a new epoch where we have to do without civil religion altogether. But we need the civil doctrine as the core. I mean, otherwise we don't have a really functioning democracy. But you can see the fragility of it. People, in a certain sense, very often feel, well, we want the security of thinking that everybody agrees too. a really established and strong foundation. Secondly, when you had these people saying, you know, I have a single principle, laïcité, wall of separation, and so on, I very strongly criticize that. I criticize that as a kind of fetishization of a certain formula. But there again, we can understand it, because modern democracies rely very strongly on a sense of common political identity. When you look at the Republican case in France, this is defined by the great moments of the revolution, by the 1905 Loi de la Séparation of church and state. And so you can see why people are deeply, deeply attached to this. So that's another reason why this model is very difficult. This model is in fact the one that flows from a recognition of the multicultural nature of all our societies. I use that word in the Canadian sense. I know it has other ramifications elsewhere. And so it's another way in which these kinds of regime have a certain fragility, if you like, a certain fragility which societies which have unanimous acceptance of their metaphysical basis don't have. A certain fragility which societies which don't need to challenge their historic markers of their political identity don't have. All right, there's a last reason why people may still want to make a special thing of religion, and that's what I want to get to, because I think we have an interesting possible difference between Jürgen and myself. And that is that some people think that there is such a thing as the language of secular reason, as against the language of various religions, and that somehow secular reason is something that everybody understands and can operate with, and religion adds extra considerations. And this seems to me to be deeply mistaken. It seems to me that when you look at the core and you ask everyone for their reasons, you know, humans have right to life. Why? Well, a Christian will say they're made in the image of God. And a Kantian might say they have the dignity of rational beings, of rational agency, and they must be respected. And a utilitarian will say, well, the only basis for behaving towards any being is whether that being can suffer, and what that puts on you as a burden is to minimize the suffering. So we even get people like Peter Singer, extension of the potential beneficiaries of this beyond the human case. These are very different answers. Now, any one of these answers is not acceptable, may not be acceptable to others. It's not just the made in the image of God. I don't buy the utilitarian thing. I'm not terribly keen, I'm not terribly against the Kantian one. There's no formula that's going to be acceptable to everyone. So what do we do with the language in which we exchange? And I think that's a big, big question. And this is this is my way of looking at that. We need, all democracies need, what you might call official language. I don't mean English or French, Spanish. I mean a set of terms in which their legislation can be couched, their court judgments can be couched, their administrative decrees can be couched. And let's take legislation as an easy example. Now, I don't know how you do this here, but when we pass resolutions where I come from, they contain their reasons. They say, whereas so-and-so, whereas so-and-so, whereas so-and-so, therefore be it resolved. Or in French, considérant, considérant, considérant. And in those whereas clauses, you state why you're legislating this particular law. They're part of the law. Now, it's clear to me that those clauses could not contain references which only make sense or which only are acceptable to one or other spiritual family. We couldn't have a whereas clause saying, whereas the Bible says that P, be it resolved. No. But we couldn't have a clause that said, whereas Marx showed that religion is the opium of the people. Oh. It'd be just as unacceptable. Unacceptable for exactly the same reason. Right? So it's not that religion is the problem. It's that we need a common language, official language, in which the body of law, both legislated and court-made, that governs our lives, can be put in terms that don't privilege one community over another. But beyond that, and very much unlike Rawls in his early phase, I think there ought to be no democratic restrictions whatsoever on how citizens argue with each other, and they should be utterly free, and indeed, I think, encouraged to state their case in terms that mean the most to them. Anyway, that's a presentation of a possible new model. I leave it with you and for the discussion. Thank you.